Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really, the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
So today, Labs, the guest I have, this guy that I knew back in
94.
Yeah, we were both at Iowa State University. We were both working at Iowa State University, one of those square states in the middle of the United States.
They're all square.
No, not all of them. The ones in the middle of the United States are all square. So, so you know what we're going to be talking today? We're going to be talking about Donald. No, actually, that was another time. We're going to be talking about Donald Trump.
America great again.
Make
America great again.
Make America?
Yeah, because he says America. He doesn't say America. He says America.
America. I didn't know that. Okay.
You've never heard him say America?
No, I've never heard him say America. So, what do you think of Donald Trump?
When he talks, you just hear, like, trumpets. Wah, 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 wah. Like, you could say Donald Trump is one of those adults from Snoopy. When they talk, you never understand them.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of putting it. But is that, I mean, is that what you, as a 13-year-old, hear when you hear him speak?
Yes.
Sort of like nothing's coming out? What about your friends at school and stuff like that? What do they say about him?
Oh, they say that he's a racist. He's racist.
Do you think he's a racist?
Sometimes.
You know what we're going to be talking about? We're going to be talking about whether or not Donald Trump is going to be impeached. In other words, you know, get kicked out of office.
I think he's going to be impeached.
You think he's going to be impeached?
Yeah.
Why do you think he's going to be impeached?
How many months has he been president? 9, right?
Well, I think it's, what, almost, it's going to be almost a year soon. Yeah.
So, for example, he's done a really stupid thing in 1 year. So, imagine what he's going to do in 4 years.
Okay, so you mean they're going to impeach him before he gets a chance to do those other stupid things?
No, I think they're going to impeach him before he gets to 4 years.
Okay, well, you know what? The thing that the bad news is that I kind of actually thought the same thing until I did this interview with Wayne Steiger, and Steiger has a much more nuanced, much more complex understanding of the U.S. political system than both you and me have.
Well, I'm 13.
And yeah, I know you're 13, and what's my excuse is what you're gonna say now, right? But he's got a much more nuanced understanding, obviously, because this is what he studies, and he's not so sure. There's a lot of things going on.
Wait, don't you study this?
Not this, not specifically. No, I study international security and national security.
No, that's what mom studies.
No, that's what I study. No, she studies public policy.
No, she studies politics.
Well, it's not exactly politics. Well, yeah, I mean, there's like lots of different types of politics. But what Wayne does is like presidential studies. Like, it looks at specifically the president of the United States. And in fact, his new book that's coming out very shortly,
Make America Great Again.
It's not Make America Great Again. It's on populism in the U.S. political system. So he's the right guy to interview about this.
Can you please tell him to dedicate it to Make America Great Again?
Do you want me to dedicate this episode to MAGA?
Who's MAGA?
Make America Great Again.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want me to do that?
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that.
Why not?
I'm just not going to do it.
You going to edit this out?
I can, yeah.
Are you going to?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Take care.
Take care.
What are you going to do?
Going to go sleep.
You don't care really, do you?
What?
About anything?
No.
No. What do you care about?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
It's like there's one thing in the world that you care about?
Walter.
The dog?
Yeah, the dog.
Okay, that's good.
Good night.
All right, so Dr. Wayne Steiger, welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast. Thank you for being with us today. How are you, Wayne?
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Wayne and I go back well, back to the mid-1990s, Wayne and I were at the University of... No, it was Iowa State, wasn't it? It wasn't the University. Iowa State in Ames, Iowa. Wayne was a junior professor there, and I was the computer tech guy in the Department of Political Science. And we got together. We hung out a lot. There's some stories. I'm not going to mention any of them.
There are stories.
There are stories. One of them involves a 2-pound burrito. Another one involves a place, a coffee shop we frequented called Whiskey River.
Right.
So
another story involves a jacket of yours that got stolen.
Do you know about that? I didn't think that got around. You know that night that the jacket was stolen, I walked back to my apartment, and halfway there I realized that I didn't have any keys because they were in the jacket.
No kidding.
And then and the Iowa State University of Iowa State patrol car stopped.
Campus
cops, yeah, they stopped and they said, "What's up?" And I said, "Well, you know, I just realized my jacket was stolen. I just realized I don't have my keys." So we went back to the station, I guess, and they had keys to my house. It was the weirdest thing because I guess it was campus housing, right? So
sure.
So they let me in, and it was really nice, actually. It wasn't that cold, though, thankfully. It was an expensive coat.
Yes, it was. Well, I remember it.
So Wayne ended up in Chicago at DePaul University, and Wayne does presidential politics. I have a CV. The summary of the podcast, Wayne's CV, will be there, so you can take a look at it. But Wayne's done a lot of work on presidential politics. His new book, which is coming out shortly, is on populism in the United States, which is, strangely enough, kind of apropos for the discussion today, because we're going to be looking at... Actually, Wayne, we discussed this before. What I want to look at is, you know, what kind of institutions, what kind of mechanisms exist in the United States to limit the power of the United States. And I'll tell you why this is an interesting question. A lot of people don't recognize the fact that in the American political system, there are these checks and balances. They do exist, and they're quite powerful. You know, in other countries, including Canada, for example, if you're prime minister, you're essentially, you know, for all intents and purposes, a dictator for 4 years. You can pretty much do whatever the heck you want. You come from the legislature. So you control the legislature. The executive and the legislature are fused in that particular instance. So, you know, even advanced democracies like Canada, I think, don't have the same kinds of checks and balances that you see in the United States. Yeah, I'm sorry, you were about to say something?
I think you could even generalize beyond that. Almost any system where you have a parliament and a prime minister winds up having a chief executive who has more authority and power than the American president.
Yeah. And
particularly when it comes to domestic policy.
You know, in the case of Canada, even foreign policy, to be honest with you. But yeah, and sure. You know what? This is going to sound strange to maybe you, Wayne, and to some listeners, because this is a security podcast, right? It's about security issues.
Sure.
Why are we talking about these kinds of things? Well, without you know, saying too many names, there are a number of policymakers and decision makers in the United States, in different agencies, that sees or views the behavior of the present president, Donald Trump, as somehow being a little troublesome. Was I diplomatic enough about that, Wayne?
I think that's a very diplomatic way of putting it. When you have senior senators of his own party questioning his, you know, his competence and state of mind, I think what you're saying is quite fair.
Okay, so I wanted to look at different things, and the first thing I wanted to look at was the investigation by the Attorney General. Specifically, the appointment of Mueller. Could you tell us a little bit what Mueller I mean, what that whole process is, because it was triggered with Clinton. Honestly, I didn't pay that much attention when it happened with Clinton. I'm paying more attention to it now. But what's that whole process about a special prosecutor in the United States, and what is Mueller investigating specifically?
Well, so there's actually a little bit of a difference between the Clinton and the Mueller case, Ken Starr.
Yeah.
So in the 1990s with Ken Starr, that was appointed by Congress. And he had essentially what it became to be about nearly $100 million worth of expenses on an investigation that went into the Clinton finance, virtually all of their financial dealings while he was governor of Arkansas, which extended into various other tangents, alleged scandals, ultimately came up with absolutely nothing that was prosecutable. And in many ways exonerated the Clintons, although, as you know, the media spin and the legal arguments being made in a court case are substantially different. The difference with Mueller is he's appointed in this case by the Attorney General, and so it's an executive appointment within the Justice Department, which is done essentially when there is a question about political allegiances. So the Justice Department tries to maintain autonomy and political independence, or at least independence from political interference. And in this case, Mueller is given essentially subpoena power. He has the ability to go to a grand jury, get subpoenas. He's essentially unlimited in what he pursues. So this has the potential to, you know, expand and tentacle, much like the Ken Starr case did in the 1990s, into, you know, what were the contacts between the campaigns. So they'll certainly be investigating the emails, not just of the campaign officials. They will be investigating emails of some Trump associates. They will be investigating email exchanges and communications between the Republican National Committee and potential Russians. But it's going to extend way beyond that. In terms of the individuals like Paul Manafort, they are going to go into his bank records, his various business dealings, where the financial transactions. They have the ability to go into Donald Trump's financial transactions. Is his businesses engaged in money laundering? That's a question that's come up. So there are all kinds of ways that this is essentially a wide open investigation. Some of it will be going after particular individuals. Did they perjure themselves? Did Donald Trump try to obstruct the case, you know, and obstruct justice by shutting down Comey through the FBI?
That's the one thing that I wanted to ask you. I mean, the whole Comey thing, the whole Mueller thing, in my mind anyways, seems to have been triggered because of the Comey dismissal.
Correct.
Would that be
correct?
Fair? Yeah.
No, I think that's entirely the case. What happened there is you had an investigation going on internally through normal procedures under the FBI, which is part of the Justice Department. Trump, with his ability,
and that was something that Comey was doing, this run of the mill investigation.
Well, I wouldn't say it was run-of-the-mill. I mean, there are units within the FBI that are set up to engage. I mean, they have all kinds of activities. So you'll have units that are engaged in, you know, tracing down, you know, violent criminal activity. You'll have investigations of counter-espionage, which is a substantial part of their activity, particularly spying on American businesses. But you also have units like we have here in Chicago devoted entirely towards political corruption. And so Comey initiates an investigation of political corruption, in this case with regard to counter-espionage, blending those two in the Russia case.
Right.
Trump has the ability to fire him because he's the FBI director and he's a direct appointee.
Okay.
That then sets up a case where they still want to pursue the investigation, but they don't want the political interference. Mm-hmm. So Mueller, as a special counselor, is no longer directly answerable to Donald Trump. He could be fired, but it would have to be done by the Justice Department, the secretary.
Okay, and he was appointed by the undersecretary because the secretary recused himself.
Recused himself, correct. Correct.
So,
but it's in the chain of command, so it's technically out of Trump's direct hand. However, Trump could fire those individuals within the Justice Department and then go, you know, and try to appoint somebody who would go ahead and fire Mueller and end the investigation. The problem is Trump could fire those people, but any replacement would need Senate confirmation. And if Trump tried to shut down this investigation in a way that he would then need Senate confirmation, that would not happen. The Senate is not going to go along with this.
And people like McCain and Lindsey Graham said that it would be the beginning of the end of his presidency if he tried to do that. Right.
Right. I think I think that's correct. I think that at that point they would be they would start to push for within the U.S. Senate impeachment as obstruction of justice, and he's been warned to that effect. And so I don't think there will be any firing of Mueller.
When you said firing of, you meant Jeff Sessions and the undersecretary.
Who
appointed Mueller, right?
Resign, right. I think they would resign before they would fire Mueller at this point. Mm-hmm. And Trump could not get a replacement approved by the U.S. Senate, all right? I think they would just obstruct that. And if they did get, they would only approve somebody who would promise not to fire Mueller. All right. That's one scenario. Another scenario is that the undersecretary does go ahead and fire Mueller. The problem there is that the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives could simply authorize their own special prosecutor, which would be completely beyond the control of the Trump administration. It essentially would go back to exactly what Ken Starr had, which was, you know, complete authority to investigate almost any aspect he wanted with subpoena power and the ability to put people under oath.
All right. So let's say Mueller finds something. Okay. What happens then?
Well, so it depends on what they find and in what context. All right. Because there are different aspects. If, for example, he finds out that Trump himself, or through his various enterprises, was engaged in money laundering, okay? That's activities that Trump engaged in as a private citizen, and he could be prosecuted for that, okay? If it was any activities
who
for Trump...
I mean, sorry, because I really don't understand. That's why I'm cutting off. Prosecuted by who? By the federal Attorney General's office?
They would refer it to the Attorney General's office, which could accept the case and prosecute it, or they could defer it. They could defer it until after the president is out of office. That's another option, and that's probably more likely in the case of his private business dealings. There's a second category here which have to do with official acts. All right. So the obstruction of justice, for example. If Mueller decides that Trump's action in firing Comey amounted to obstruction of justice, then that would be referred to the U.S. Senate as, or to the U.S. House as something for that they could take up as a matter of impeachment. The obstruction of justice charge.
Okay, so it wouldn't be the Attorney General's office that would
correct.
Would refer to the House
Anything that the they find that Trump did as president would be something that could not be pursued as something prosecutable while Trump is president. And so by the U.S. Justice Department, it would be referred to the U.S. House. In the case of impeachment, the U.S. House operates as a grand jury, which simply decides, is there sufficient evidence for that a crime has been committed? That sends it to the Senate, which actually conducts the trial.
Okay. So that's another path. Well, what if they find that's the obstruction of justice with the firing of Comey.
Correct.
What about the Russian connection then?
Well, so the Russian connection, the Russian connection, I mean, there's so many different ways this could possibly be, all right? If there was collusion by his campaign, what most likely would happen is that they would go after the individuals in the campaign, all right? Mm-hmm. And apparently, you know, per media reports, target number one appears to be Paul Manafort. Mm-hmm. What they will do is they'll investigate Paul Manafort for perjury. They will look at, to see any of his statements to the FBI, were they legal or not. They will look to see if he, as he apparently has, failed to report that he was working as a foreign agent employed by foreign governments, in this case Ukraine, potentially Russian companies, while he was working in the United States. That's another violation of federal law. And so he could be prosecuted. And typically with the Justice Department.
For the listeners who don't know who Paul Manafort is, he was Donald Trump's campaign manager.
He was his second campaign manager, who really took over from about April mm-hmm. until just after the Republican convention. So the Russian story broke in the media, mm-hmm. and immediately, within 3 or 4 days, Paul Manafort resigned from the campaign.
Right. Yeah, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? The timing of all that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was such an immediate, like, holy cow, there's a scandal here, that he had to get off the campaign. And as it turned out, you know, he's had unreported income. You know, I mean, Paul Manafort's in trouble. The typical pattern for the Justice Department in these cases, U.S. attorneys, is to go after the individual, you know, threaten them with substantial penalties, prison mm-hmm. time, and it, with the expectation that they're going to cut a deal and testify against a higher up, a bigger fish.
Right, because
that's modus operandi.
Right, that appears to be what has actually happened. Manafort appears to be cooperating. Who could he implicate?
He could implicate other people in the campaign. He could implicate perhaps Donald Trump's sons. He could possibly Kushner, his son-in-law. He could possibly implicate Donald Trump himself.
Well, okay, so what happens if
I suspect that's probably not the case.
Why?
Because I don't think Donald Trump, just based on what we observed in his campaign and what we observed with him as president, I think he is so far removed from the day-to-day operations, all right, that it would be really hard to find a smoking gun that would be credible and hold up as a court case. I think what you had are Trump's people.
Yeah.
May have been working with the Russians, and it may not even be direct quid pro quo. It mm-hmm. could be what we would call tacit collusion, mm-hmm. where there's a signaling game going on. The various Russian delegations, individuals representing directly or indirectly the Russian government, you know, basically finding out, is Trump favorable to Russian positions? Would he suspend sanctions? And then they independently can go and act as, you know, to support him, even though there's no explicit deal made. They can do it in anticipation. That wouldn't necessarily implicate Trump, but it would certainly suggest that the campaign was involved. Hard to prove in a court of law.
Okay, fair enough. It would be hard to prove, but... You know, before the beginning of the interview, we were talking about the fact that Trump doesn't seem to criticize Putin, even with what's going on. I mean, it's just amazing that he doesn't do it, right?
Right.
Doesn't that suggest if there is some kind of connection with the Russians, that it may actually involve
Donald
Trump himself? Yeah.
Yeah, it may be. But all I was saying in my prior comments was just pertaining to campaign collusion. There could be other issues where, as has been reported and speculated about repeatedly in the U.S. media, that Trump has financial dealings, that, you know, as part of the original report that came out of the United Kingdom, that, you know, an individual in the U.K. With affiliation with British intelligence, that you know, Trump had, there were some scandalous dirt with a sex scene in Moscow. Any of those things could possibly be real. And Trump could very much be far more sympathetic out of fear for his financial empire. You know, what kind of business dealings did he have? I suspect, personal opinion, not, you know, any inside information, that Trump is first and foremost concerned about his financial empire than anything else.
Okay, so if what you're saying is true, this all happened before he was even a candidate for presidency, right? So if they find business dealings and stuff like that, does that get him in trouble?
Yeah, sure. I mean, those things could be prosecuted, although typically what happens with a sitting president is that they would not prosecute him until he was out of office.
Okay, so it's not something that's impeachable.
Yeah, that wouldn't be something that's impeachable because it didn't involve him and his actions as president.
Okay.
To this point, about the only thing that we have that would broach us in the realm of impeachment is, did he obstruct justice by trying to interfere and stop the Comey investigation?
Okay, so the Comey obstruction of justice is the issue then, as far as
really
his political future.
As, you know, correct. Well, I mean, there's his political future is a broad topic. Okay,
fair enough. His presidency,
regarding his ability. Yeah. Right. The ability just to survive or not survive, continue in office, is a matter of impeachment. I mean, when we talk about, you know, what's the public reaction, I mean, that's a whole nother realm. Because even impeachment, at the end of the day, has very little to do with the law as much as it is, does he have majorities in the House and Senate that would be willing to impeach him? As long as his political support among the Republican Party activist base, meaning people are going to vote in caucuses and primaries for members of Congress. Mm-hmm. As long as that stays strong, there's no way a majority of Republicans would even agree to bring this up. Without a majority of Republicans, it is highly doubtful that Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the U.S. House, would even allow this to go forward in the House.
However, okay, so it's
so we're really talking about a minority of the population. As long as he maintains the support of a minority of the population, realistically, he is not going to face impeachment.
All right, so hypothetically, Mueller could go to the House with the evidence, and Ryan would say, you know what, we're not gonna deal with this.
Correct.
Huh. Okay, so there isn't any kind of automatic
in the House.
Yeah.
No, there is not an automatic mechanism. Impeachment ultimately is a political act. And we've had twice, we've seen the House of Representatives act on impeachment. Mm-hmm. Okay, one was with Andrew Johnson in the aftermath of the Civil War, dealing with the punitive actions taken by Congress and punishment of Southerner white males who had served in the Confederate Army or in the government. The second case where impeachment occurred in the House was under Bill Clinton. With Nixon, it was Congress moving towards impeachment, and he resigned in anticipation that it would happen. So we've only actually had two presidents where articles of impeachment have been passed by the House. In both the cases, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, the Senate voted against impeachment.
Okay.
And it largely has to do with the popularity of the president.
So without a majority vote in the House, this wouldn't move forward. And
correct.
And because he controls the House, or at least because there's a majority of Republicans.
Yes.
What about defections the House?
The defections could happen. So you bring up a very important point, and that is, it is possible for 218 members of the House, a majority, to sign a petition, a discharge petition, which forces a committee to engage, to produce, in this case, articles of impeachment. Mm-hmm. So Democrats siding with a minority of Republicans, who would most likely be admitting to ending their political careers at this point, as long as Trump maintains support. Mm-hmm. To agree to work with Democrats to impeach a Republican president. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that is highly likely. I mean, right now, until Trump starts losing support of his own base, I think impeachment is highly unlikely. I think far more likely, if we talk about impeachment, is that this whole scandal just continues to drag out because the investigation is going to take time. And it becomes a central issue in the 2018 elections, and in which, if this and other, you know, if Congress cannot enact laws, if they cannot function, it is possible that the Republicans lose control of the House. A Democratic majority certainly could pursue impeachment in 2018.
Okay. Would they, by the way? I mean, wouldn't it be in the Democrats' interest to just let him...
Yes, I think the Democratic Party base would be interested in it. I think there would be some element among the elites of being interested, as if only for payback for the Clinton years, you know, the pursuit of impeachment. And it certainly would put, you know, the Republicans on the defensive going into 2020. So the end game here is really about playing to public support for both political parties.
Like you said, it's political more than... than a justice issue,
it's
isn't it?
Political more than a matter of legal implications.
All right,
because it's ultimately in the hands of political officers.
Okay, well, let's switch a little bit and talk about his cabinet. Does the cabinet have any kind of authority or power to, to take him out? Remove him as president if they feel that he's somehow a threat?
Yeah, so there is...
Or mentally unstable, which is something that, you said, a number of congressmen...
So, it is possible. I don't know the exact procedural requirements, but yes, it is possible for appointees of the president to basically get him declared as... physically or mentally unable to complete the job. The difficulty is they would have to act so surreptitiously, all right, that nobody leaks this to Trump, because Trump could fire the individuals before they could engage in that kind of usurpation of power. So that's, I think, pretty unlikely. But, you know, Democrats have, in a sense, fantasized about that as an option. I mean, one of the quirky things that foreign audiences, meaning audiences outside the United States, may not have a feel for is that Donald Trump still retains substantial popular support among active Republicans in the United States.
It's like 60%, right? I think that's the number.
Yeah, 60%. Well, that's 60% of all people who self-identify as Republican.
Yeah.
If we look at the people who are likely to participate in caucuses and primaries, which is what matters for members of Congress seeking their own re-elections next year, it's probably a slightly higher percentage, and higher in some states than others. If we're talking Midwestern states, you know, Tennessee, Kentucky, Southern states, we're talking about a very high percentage of retaining support. Where he's lost support is largely geographical. So New York, California Republicans don't think as much about him. Republicans in large urban areas don't think as much about him, but they never really did. Highly educated Americans don't, you know, Republicans don't support him. But, you know, he has this base, that's populist base, that is very powerful.
Well,
is changing the party.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to make one of those stupid assumptions that you see on Facebook that, you know, if you're a supporter of Trump now, you're a racist, and, you know, given what happened in Charlottesville and so forth. Because supporters are seeing this kind of stuff, right? And why doesn't it matter? Why doesn't it matter to them? I'm not saying they're racist. To me, it looks as though it doesn't seem to. They don't seem to think it's important.
I think that's generally right for most Republicans. It's not a high priority for them. And there's a segment, perhaps not trivial, but a minority of Republicans that, if anything, laud it. And it's not so much that they're supportive of Trump. Trump has a very particular skill, and that is turning around the argument. All right, if you don't support me, you're pro-political correctness, right? And Republicans, it's not so much that they're pro-race, but they really hate diversity. They hate multiculturalism. They hate political correctness. It's not so much that they support Donald Trump. I'm trying to think of another policy area. It's not so much that,
it's not that they support the KKK. It's just that...
Correct. Yeah. Correct. They hate the Democrats more than they like Trump. And they will back Trump to the end because they hate the alternative. Mm-hmm. And so that gives Trump a lot of flexibility.
Wow, I wasn't aware of that. I really thought that he was hanging on by a thread. It sounds like
No, you got to realize. So, I mean, the concept of motivated reasoning and party bias. I mean, Republicans see the world so very differently than neutral observers, from foreign observers. Democrats see the world very differently than Republicans. What are the important facts? What are the important issues? They can look at the same piece of evidence and interpret it very differently. You know, in a sense, it's the difference between a glass is half full versus a glass is half empty. But it's more substantial than that. I mean, there is fundamental acceptance of Donald Trump, and in many ways lauding his anti-establishment, anti-immigration, anti-political correctness, anti-climate change agenda. And, you know, they may not be aware of the implications of that. Yeah. It's just that it's opposition to the Democrats, it's opposition to Obama, it's opposition to the Washington insider establishment.
To the Clintons?
They're lauding it.
To the Clintons also?
To the Clintons, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And so there's a lot of this kind of undirected anger that Trump has managed to tie in and give it direction, and because of that, give it force. And right now it's almost entirely operating within the Republican Party. And if you're a Republican representative or a Republican senator, this is far more dangerous to you than the Democrats.
And that kind of brings us into your book, right? The new book, which talks about socioeconomic cultural factor. I don't know if it's the cultural factor, but the socioeconomic factors and populism in the United States.
Sure.
Could you tell us a little bit about what the argument there is?
Yeah, sure. The argument is, first of all, populism. I'm going to define what I mean by that. Populism is anti-establishment. It takes left-wing populism, right-wing populism differ in this regard. For left-wing populism, it's, you know, it's Bernie Sanders, anti-oligarchs, anti-billionaires, anti-Wall Street, anti-CEOs. It's much more class-based. It's social democratic, you know, opposition to corporate structure and their enablers within the government.
But Trump's right-wing a populist also, right?
Right. So he's a right-wing populist. And so right-wing populism is a little more complex. It's first and foremost anti-government, all right? Mm-hmm. Whereas Bernie is anti-billionaire, anti-rich people. Trump is first and foremost anti-government because government facilitates special interests, never defined, never given an example of what is a special interest, but presumably Wall Street in some form. But secondly, it's also anti-government for catering to people who are considered to be undeserving poor, immigrants. Mm-hmm. In the case of the United States, Muslims, African Americans, people who haven't worked, contributed to social welfare, but take social welfare programs. Mm-hmm. All right? And so there's this kind of American populism is anti-government, right-wing American populism is anti-government with respect to some kind of special interest and for helping the poor at the expense of the middle class, who've been ignored and forgotten and froze out. And so there's this people, and the people as real Americans, to quote, you know, George Wallace and Sarah Palin, and for Donald Trump, MAGA, you know, the Make America Great Again, white middle class working people against these different establishments. And so that's the dominant thread. The final thing about it is the politics of victimization. And Donald Trump has been extremely good, and as have Republican populists in the Tea Party, of portraying themselves as victims, all right? Republicans are accused of discriminating against gays and lesbians. they turn it around. Democrats are denying us our religious freedom. We are being oppressed. There's a lot of immigration. The country's becoming browner. They're taking away our traditions. Political correctness, promotion of diversity. They're denying us our ethnic heritage, our way of life. And so, you know, it's this politics of victimization gives, you know, in a sense, discriminatory behavior, which would be, you know, rejected by large numbers of people on its face value, but it's flipped around. And it's saying it's our freedom of speech that's being threatened. It's our way of life that's being threatened. We're the victims here. And it gives legitimacy to otherwise offensive arguments. And it helps mobilize people who may not support it if they were, for example, racist. All right. But it's okay to be, you know, against undeserving poor as a matter of self-preservation because you're the victim. And it gives right-wing populists and some more unsavory elements legitimization that otherwise would not exist. And so populism has become a pretty powerful force now, in that regard.
Okay, so, and that's exactly, the sentiment is exactly what Trump tapped into and to a great extent explains why he won the election. How
and continues to maintain support.
And continues to maintain support, yeah. But people are kind of shocked at that. I mean, people outside of the United States are kind of shocked, and I guess people inside the U.S. are shocked.
Absolutely.
That you know, there's a significant portion of the population that feels that way. Is it? But this isn't new, Wayne, right? I mean, this has been something that's a part of American political culture for a couple of hundred years, right?
Yeah. In fact, that's spot on. All right. Populism is about as American as apple pie. And right-wing populism, left-wing populism have long, long traditions. If we go back to the very founding of the United States, the two kind of breakaway documents that matter for rationalization for what we call the American Revolution or the War of Independence, one is the Declaration of Independence, authored by Thomas Jefferson, but the other one is a document called Common Sense by Thomas Paine, who became kind of a hero of the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. Those are essentially populist documents. They're anti-elitism. And then populism kind of wanes. It's rhetorically used by Andrew Jackson, but when he's president, he really doesn't govern as a populist. And populism kind of fades away. It reemerges after the Civil War. It becomes very big among rural agrarian interests in the 1880s, 1890s, which kind of mutates into progressivism in the earlier part of the 20th century. After World War II, left-wing populism kind of dies away, this more class-based union worker against the, you know, the economic elites. And we see this cultural populism emerging in the 1950s. And it, you know, it picks up steam.
What do you mean?
Richard Nixon. It picks up steam within the United States and within the Republican Party.
What's the cultural populism? How is that different from
before? So the cultural side, the nativism, the kind of our traditional way of life, the anti-immigration, racist elements, white pride, if you will, white nationalism. That's that cultural side, and religious freedom, gun ownership. I mean, there's a lot of different civil libertarian issues that are fundamentally at stake here. And the idea is that government needs to get involved to protect our freedoms against, you know, kind of the cosmopolitan left, college-educated urban intellectuals have come to dominate the country.
And this comes about in the 50s?
Yeah, it really starts to emerge in the 1950s. Absolutely. It picks up steam. You know, Richard Nixon's silent majority was certainly about the people, kind of what Sarah Palin would call real Americans, that blue collar that isn't politically active, but here's their voice and they're not represented and I'm speaking for them. George Wallace, you know, at the time a Democrat, the opposing desegregation. Mm-hmm. He was essentially running a right-wing populist campaign, although in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan, has a lot of populist rhetoric. So Donald Trump, and then you get Pat Buchanan in the 1990s. So Donald Trump certainly isn't doing anything new here. He's just doing it more effectively, and he has a better, more, you know, the ability to take advantage of social media, Twitter, amplified by Facebook, you know, right-wing blogs amplifying that viewpoint. And all of a sudden, he's able to do what prior right-wing populists have never been able to do. And he's operating in a context where more Americans are angry and frustrated with our political system than probably any time in the last century.
Yeah, this is second to last question because I've kept you for way too long. Is there a danger here for the
democracy?
American...
Absolutely.
Well, democracy, the system, the institutions, etc., yeah.
Yeah, no, there's incredible danger. I mean, that's the debate that's going on among, you know, academics who study populism. Is it a correction on elites? Is this something that's kind of a wake-up call? Hey, political establishment, you've been ignoring people, you know, average middle-class Americans for too long, worried about particular other issues and special interests that, you know, and you're going to try and kind of coax them into being responsive? Or... Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, a prelude to kind of suitable disruption and really the end of the polity as we've known it? It's an open question at this point.
I guess
and that's a wild moment to leave you with.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, is that...
Go ahead.
If there was a second term, that would be much more dangerous, wouldn't it? I mean, that would have very significant implications.
So while Trump maintains support of the majority of what is essentially a minority of the population, I don't think at this point it is conceivable that he could win election a second time. And I say that being pretty darn convinced a year ago today that he would not have won the White House. So, you know, I've clearly been wrong. Although a forecasting model that I'm involved with, we did predict that he was going to win the Republican nomination.
Okay.
Not getting a lot of credit for, but... but yeah, so...
You're famous with me, Wayne.
Maintaining enough support.
What's that? I was going to say, you're famous in Mexico with me, so don't worry if you felt like you didn't get enough... credit for that prediction there.
That's all right. It's kind of a nefarious prediction.
When what would be like warning signs? You know, early warning signs.
I think the warnings. I think we see some of it, and that is the public not being willing to accept the legitimacy of court decisions. The right wing simply not accepting the legitimacy of government policies, civil disobedience, the breakdown of authority. And as you know, as somebody who deals with national security and you know, policy issues, if you lose legitimacy in the eyes of a substantial portion of the public, the only way to maintain power is through coercion. But that is not sustainable in the long term. Governments fundamentally depend on the legitimacy of elected officials. And if Trump is able to undermine that legitimacy, that's the beginning of the end of the republic as we know it.
Wow. All right. That is kind of scary.
So, yeah, it's scary stuff.
Let me ask you another scary question, and then we'll finish with this, okay? We're in the middle of a nuclear crisis right now. Kim Jong-un is a freaking nutcase, and we all know that. But Trump has a temper.
Right.
Hypothetically.
Uninformed and impulsive, yes.
Yeah, impulsive. He may feel as though his masculinity might somehow be threatened by, you know, I mean, when he comes out and he says that, you know, I'm happy that the North Koreans have come to we've come to an understanding, and then 1 week later Kim Jong Un blows this thing up, so
launches another missiles. Yeah.
Well, If he gets a little too impulsive. If he gets a little too impulsive. And you know what I mean, right?
Sure.
Who could stop him?
Is there anything to restrain him?
Yeah, okay, right,
well,
good.
The answer is the issue of restraint, and that is with nuclear power and the use of force, this is the singular area, if you look at where the, even more or arguably as much as pardonability, it is really the ability to commit forces. It would be treasonous for any uniformed officer, which would include his Joint Chiefs of Staff, his Air Force, to deny the president, okay? Now, that said, so in principle, there is nothing to prevent Trump from starting a war with North Korea, even engaged in a preemptive first strike. Nothing prevents that, in theory. In practice, what happens is that there's a second authorization, which is that Trump gives the okay to go ahead with a nuclear strike, which then has to be seconded and approved by a second voice. And
yeah, which
like
is
the two key mechanisms.
Right, it's the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State,
I think.
Yeah.
It's the Secretary of Defense.
Ah, okay.
The problem is, if the Secretary of Defense defies the order, he can be replaced.
Right.
It automatically has to be replaced.
Right.
Okay? Which would drop it down. So, you know, while in principle there's no restraint here, in practice, as long as nobody is willing to say yes as that second voice, there's a practical procedural limitation on the ability of the president to execute the order.
Can you see a scenario where a chief says no?
I would hope that the president's people who have surrounded him are, in fact, more sane and unwilling to engage in basically an attack that would cost tens of millions of lives on both sides of the Korean border.
Right, right.
So,
but it seems.
And I hope we're not engaged in groupthink and wishful thinking.
Yeah, but it sounds much more tenuous. It's much more. It's a much more political.
Right. So the issue is, you really need to restrain him before he makes that decision, through advising and trying to deter him through verbal reasoning.
But they have trouble
doing
that.
We will see where that goes.
They have trouble doing that.
I think they have a great. I think they have a great deal of trouble. I absolutely think they have a great deal of trouble with it.
Do you think Kelly's Kelly as chief of staff is gonna
the gravitas? Yeah, I think he has the ability to restrain him. I think Trump will go weary of him. My prediction is that Kelly makes it to January and is finished.
Huh.
He'll replace him. I think you'll see a wholesale movement again of officials.
Wow. Interesting. That's all right. I was going to say interesting times. You know, the way the Chinese say, "May you live in interesting times."
All right,
Dr. Wayne Steiger, thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Ristoulis.
All right, bro. I love you, man.
All right, thanks, man.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.